Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report Washington Roundtable. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. House Speaker Mike Johnson is putting his job on the line by relying on Democrats to pass more aid for Ukraine as more Russian strikes are hitting Ukrainian targets for lack of offensive and defensive weapons. Days after the first ever direct Iranian attack on Israel that was blunted by the Jewish state's allies, Jerusalem has attacked a site in Iran, sparking concerns of escalation, even as both sides now, as we record this, appear to be tamping down tensions. Russia is getting bolder in sowing anti-Semitism in the United States, attacking a Texas water authority as Germany arrests two Russian spies planning to attack an American base in the country where Ukrainians are being trained. High-level defense dialogue between Washington and Beijing as the United States and Philippine forces prepare to conduct exercises, and Australia increases defense spending as North Korea celebrates its Kim Il-sung holiday in slightly different fashion. Joining us today to discuss all this and more are Dr. Patrick Cronin, the Asia-Pacific Security Chair at the Hudson Institute Think Tank, Michael Herson, the President of American Defense International, one of Washington's top defense and aerospace lobbying firms, former Pentagon Europe Chief Jim Townsend, who is now with the Center for a New American Security, and a co-host of the Brussels Sprouts podcast, a must for anybody interested in the Transatlantic Alliance, who is also now spending some time in Paris teaching at one of the world's truly great institutions, Sciences Po, and former Pentagon Comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, who counts the Center for Strategic and International Studies among his many affiliations. Everybody, welcome back. It is a pleasure to have you all convened. And before we get started, the Defense and Aerospace Report and its family of publications is brought to you by HII, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, GE Aerospace, Bell, Leonardo DRS, American Rheinmetall, and TE Connectivity. Again, everybody, welcome to the program. Michael, 8 months late, but better late than never. Speaker Johnson truly is doing the right thing, as he promised that he would do, to allow America to keep its promises to its allies, Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. But rather than adopt the Senate's version of that $95 billion or so dollar legislation, he's broken it up into individual buckets. That prompted Russia's useful idiots in Congress. I have no other nicer way of putting it that way. And in fact, some illustrious Republican lawmakers have said the same thing, move to try to block the Ukraine measure and indeed interfere with the other measures in other ways as well, because they suddenly want border security, even though they had a border security deal done, just a little while ago. Courageously, the speaker is getting this through because Democrats have gotten that measure through the Rules Committee, a very important first step, historically a committee that is under the total control of the Speaker. Walk us through where we are, because there is a lot of mechanics before we even get to write FISA and impeachments and all of that other kind of stuff.
Yes. So you're right. This is going to be an incredibly eventful week, and there still is a lot of mechanics that have taken place and still a little bit of ways to go. But I do believe we're going to get there. And I think we talked about this several weeks ago, as to, you asked me when I thought we would get there. And I said May. It looks like we're going to get there instead the last week in April. So actually earlier than I thought we would.
Okay. It's still 8 months late, but okay. Better late than ever.
Exactly. So
before you wear a holdout in your shoulder, right? continue. Sorry for a
bit. I know. So Johnson, Speaker Johnson, on Monday night convened his Republican conference earlier than expected. And it was anticipated to be kind of like a listening session, but instead he came in and laid it down. This is what we're going to do. We are going forward with these aid packages. And he said to the group, he's going to split them up into three separate bills, one for Ukraine, one for Israel, one for Taiwan, and then do a fourth, what they're calling sidecar, piece of legislation that would have be a hodgepodge of other policies that are favored by Republicans, but also agreed to by the Democrats. So we'll talk about that in a minute. Now, Johnson's done a very good job of making himself available to his caucus. And I think sometimes, it does more harm than good for him, because he's got, a strong cadre of folks that just want chaos and don't want to govern. So on Tuesday, he met with his conference. And Congressman Thomas Massey from Kentucky stood up in the conference meeting and said that Johnson should resign as a result of moving these bills forward. He then said that he would support Marjorie Taylor Greene's motion to vacate resolution. And lastly, he said, we have a rudder But we're steering everything toward what Chuck Schumer wants. And it's total nonsense, right? Because there are a lot of Republicans that want these aid packages passed. But right. People like Massey live in an alternate universe. On Wednesday, they announced these pieces of legislation, released them. So very much similar to the Senate bill. The funding level mirrors the Senate bill at $95.3 billion. First package for Ukraine is just over $60 billion. As we anticipated, $48 billion of that would go to the Pentagon to replenish weapon systems and pay for our costs, military operations in Europe, some money for economic assistance for Ukraine. The Israel package is $26 billion. That would fund Iron Dome, David Sling, another Israeli system called Iron Beam, which is a high energy laser weapon system. It would also cover other Israeli weapons purchases and, of course, paid to cover U.S. military operations in the Middle East, which also includes our activity in the Red Sea. The last one is $8.1 billion to counter China in the Pacific. So $2 billion for weapons purchases for Taiwan, other allies, additional money to replenish U.S. equipment that we provided to Taiwan, and very importantly, $3.3 billion for our submarine industrial base. The fourth package, which was also unveiled, will include banning TikTok. So now we're forcing the Senate to take that up. Right. It will also include the Repo Act, which allows us to seize Russian assets. It will include sanctions on Russia and China and Iran. It will include Lend-Lease Act for military aid and convertible loans for economic and humanitarian assistance to Ukraine. So the administration continues to make their case on the Hill. Lloyd Austin and C.Q. Brown warned lawmakers earlier this week that if Ukraine can't hold out for much longer because they're facing tremendous shortages in ammo and artillery. Mike McCord also said our military readiness is going to take a hit if we don't get this done. And Johnson came out very, very strong. And this week he said this is a critical time right now and a critical time on the world stage. And he said what he's doing here, he believes is the right thing to provide lethal aid to Ukraine. And now it's critically important. And he believes that Vladimir Putin would continue to march through Europe if we don't stop him. And he might go to the Balkans next. He might have a showdown with Poland. He might go against one of our NATO allies, which Poland is. He said he'd rather send bullets to Ukraine than American boys. And most importantly, at the end, he said, this is not a game. This is not a joke. And he's right. But unfortunately, there's a lot of Republicans that treat this like a game and like a joke. And last night, Donald Trump tried to derail this by saying on Truth Social, why isn't Europe giving more money to help Ukraine? You know, why is the United States giving so much more money to Ukraine than Europe when we have an ocean between us, a separation? And that you know, we can't, why can't Europe match the amount of money that we're putting in? Everyone agrees Ukrainian survival and strength should be much more important to Europe than to us. Everyone agrees. I mean, what is this guy talking about, right? And by the way,
the Europeans are already doing an enormous amount of money. So is the EU, and we'll hear from Jim in a second about it. So it's a complete baloney. We're in the vanguard of military aid, but I think if it goes to international, you know, in terms of just broader economic aid, I think Europe is ahead of us. If I'm not mistaken, really quick, Jim, am I right about that?
Yes, absolutely. You're right about that. And we will talk about it more. But if you total up all of the sums going from Europe across the board for Ukraine, is twice what U.S. is providing.
Thank you very much for that, Monsieur Professor at Sciences Po. Continue, Michael. I just wanted to set everybody's, you know, just, I mean, get, just to back up your argument about why that's absurdist.
No, you're right. And thank you. And it's absurd. It shows, again, this guy learned nothing, you know, in 4 years in office, and thinking that an ocean will separate us, will protect us against our adversaries is complete idiocy. So then to make matters even more entertaining, Marjorie Taylor Greene introduced a series of amendments to these aid packages. So one would, to the Israel bill, would fund a space laser technology on the southern border. She also wants Iron Dome deployed to our southern border. She floated a measure that require any House lawmaker who votes for the Ukraine.
What are they going to be shooting? Are folks going to get shot over the border? And we're like, what's?
It's anyway. Nonsense. Look, Trump wants to fire Patriot missiles into Mexico to stop drug production. I mean, these people have no clue. So she says that she wants to require every House lawmaker who votes for the Ukraine funding to conscript into the Ukrainian military. She proposed redirecting the Ukraine funding to victims of last year's wildfires in Maui, Hawaii, the East Palestine train disaster in Ohio, and also to be used to deport undocumented migrants. She also submitted an amendment that would bar any funding to Ukraine until Ukraine bans abortion and turns over all information related to Hunter Biden. And another one of her amendments would offset the costs with the salaries of any congressman who voted to support this package. Right. So Congressman Jared Moskowitz, who's a Democrat, floated some amendments as alternatives. He suggested renaming Marjorie Taylor Greene's office the Neville Chamberlain Room, and he offered an amendment that had to have Marjorie Taylor Greene named as Vladimir Putin's special envoy to the United States Congress. So then later on Thursday, there was a vote to condemn the Iranian attack against Israel. Pretty easy thing to vote for, right? Nope, 13 Democrats voted against it, including Pramila Jayapal, who is the chair of the Progressive Caucus. I texted with several Democratic members who all expressed dismay at how she can remain chair of the Progressive Caucus when she votes against condemning an attack against Israel. And these people portray themselves as peace activists, but of course, not when Israel is being attacked or Jews are getting killed. Last night, the Rules Committee met, and in something that was really very, very unusual, the Democrats gave the votes to the Republicans to get the rule out of committee. Four Democrats voted in favor of the rule because three Republicans are opposed. And we expect now this rule will go to the floor today for consideration, and Democrats will also help the Republicans on that vote, and that rule will get passed. And then this is teed up for a vote. All four of these bills will be voted on Saturday, very unusual Saturday session to get these passed. And then even more unusual, because people understand the urgency of this, the Senate now will stay in session next week to deal with these pieces of legislation, which will now, under the rule, the House will pass these four bills. The way the rule is structured, it combines into one bill when it gets sent to the Senate. So the Senate will vote on one package sometime next week.
And your expectation is it's going to get right through the Senate, right?
Yes. No, it's not a slam dunk. This is very similar to the Senate bill that passed several months ago. They got 70 votes. I don't think they can get 70 votes. I think there will be less than that. And it does include some things that were not in the original Senate bill, but I do expect this to be done. This has taken a lot of hard work. This is what's called a five corners agreement. That means that the Senate Majority Leader, Senate Minority Leader, House Speaker, House Minority Leader, and the White House were involved in putting this together and making this work.
I think it's amazing. And what's interesting is everybody, folks have said, including on our team, rightfully, that, wow, Johnson really owes Jeffries. But I think what the minority leader should do is make it absolutely clear the speaker owes him nothing. And this is not a quid pro quo. This is important for America and it's worth doing. Otherwise, I think it becomes toxic and very problematic. Right. I mean, overall. And what happens to Johnson as speaker? Right. I mean, folks are going to want to go after him. And he said, it's not about my job. It's about doing the right thing. So we right. could end up with Speaker Jordan, I suppose. Where does this go?
We will never end up with Speaker Jordan. I just wanted
to see if you were paying attention.
I think it's a very good question. And I think the media is making some unnecessary drama out of this. We do expect a motion to vacate after these bills pass. Right. And the Democrats have indicated that they will give Johnson what they'll do at that point is a motion to table. The motion to vacate, and the Democrats will vote for the motion to table, and this will be behind us.
You've heard it from Nancy Pelosi, you've heard it from Jeffries, you've heard it from Adam Smith, you've heard it from, some of the more, important voices in the Democratic caucus saying, we're not going to help anybody get rid of this guy.
Right. And again, it shows the Democrats care about governing, right? Politically, it'll be very advantageous to them. To have this chaos in the Republican conference in election year. They understand the moment in their meeting.
Hopefully there's more stuff that we can do in a bipartisan manner and just get the ball moving, even if it is in an election year. And again, I'm very, very dismayed. The Senate had a great measure. House should have taken it up. And alas, we would have had border reform as well, something that we desperately need. And many, many other problems that we ought to be tackling. Let me shift gears a little bit because time is short. We have a lot to discuss. Can you give me just a very quick FISA and impeachment note real fast before we get to Israel? Because we've got to address that. A lot of stuff going on in Asia and obviously in Europe as well. But go ahead real quick on FISA and Mayorkas et cetera.
Yes, this is very, very fast. So speaking of fast, Mayorkas's Senate trial was the fastest impeachment trial in Senate history. Both counts were dismissed in a matter of hours. And now that is all done. As far as FISA is concerned, there were some procedural votes earlier in this week in the Senate to move it forward. But there are several senators who want amendments offered to FISA. And in order to agree to a time agreement to get the bill passed before it expires at midnight tonight. But some of these amendments, they're feared that could pass. And if those amendments pass, that changes the bill. We have to go back to the House again. So I think it's unlikely that they agree to that. And it's very possible that we have a very short-term expiration of FISA, but it will get passed sometime this weekend.
Right, because it expires tonight at midnight, right?
Yes, correct.
Okay. Dove, thanks very much again for joining us twice this week. You joined us on Monday for the program, given the extraordinary events of last weekend, last night, Israel, you know, sort of, and it's a sovereign state. It's allowed to do whatever it wants for its own security, attacked several sites in Iran around Isfahan, obviously a very important nuclear facility there. Patrick, you've actually been there, so I want to invite you into this conversation as well. You know, afterwards, there was a sense that Tehran would do a larger attack. Everybody knows last weekend, more than 300, you know, about 120 ballistic missiles, 170 explosive drones, and 30 to 40 cruise missiles were shot against Israel. And it was really the triumph of an international coalition, Israeli forces being joined by US, UK, France, Jordan, Iraqis participating in it, right? I mean, ultimately to try to winnow this threat down. There was unfortunately one Israeli casualty. All of Israel's allies asked Bibi not to respond. And indeed, President Biden said the United States wouldn't be involved in a counterattack. Iran's attack backfired. It revealed the regime is impotent. And this strike underscores that impotence, right? We took on a military facility across the street from your nuclear facility. You have been warned. My concern is whether the Iranians under a Haidari, you know, increasingly Haidari right-wing messianic kookery might be actually approaching a nuclear capability, which might embolden it actually to miscalculate. And again, connected with some Israeli leaders who are, you know, Dove, you've noted, are where are we right now? Israel was able to defend itself because of an international coalition. You know, the United States might be willing to take multiple fingers in the eye. It's maybe a little bit less clear that France and Britain will want to take fingers in the eye. There are a lot of very good historical reasons why Jordan participated in the defense, even though the government is coming under attack or criticism from its population for helping the Israelis out at a time when the Israelis are killing Palestinians in Gaza. I should note 60% of Jordan is of Palestinian descent at this point. Walk us through the dynamics, where we are. And does, you know, what does Israel risk alienating some of its partners? I mean, what are the dynamics here that you see? And we'll get to the Iranian dimension in a minute, because I'm sort of stunned at the inability of the Israelis to properly understand what Iranian red lines are and aren't.
Well, first, I think it's important to step back because Michael talked about some of the people voting even against the Iranian attack on Israel and voting in effect against Israel. One of the things I heard yesterday from my Republican friends on the Hill, members, was that they had to get the rule through because they could not get 2/3 of the House to vote for the package, the 4-part package, because they needed 2/3 and they weren't going to get them in a large, to a great degree, because of the Democrats. And I think this Israeli strike is not going to help win any of those Democrats over. So it's not Jayapal. It's a lot of her progressives as well. And that has to be borne in mind as you evaluate reactions to this latest Israeli strike. Just a couple of points to correct. It wasn't Iraq that supported the Israelis the last time around. It was actually Saudi Arabia. Some of the attacks seem to have come from Iraq. And the person who was killed, that's kind of interesting, was an 8-year-old Bedouin girl. Right. And so, you know, the Iranians couldn't care less, of course. The thing about the current strike is, yes, the Israelis demonstrated that they can penetrate Iran Well, everybody kind of knew that, but they showed it. Now, does that mean they would strike Iranian nuclear facilities? Patrick will tell you he visited Isfahan. It's not all that easy to do. It's not all that easy to do to most of those facilities. And in any event, the Israelis don't have the capability to strike all of them, which means if they strike only some of them, the Iranians still have the nuclear capability. The reason they can't strike all of them is because Iran is just too big. It's the size of Texas. And I don't think the United States would support it. And talking about support, here's the real issue for them. 99% of those Iranian drones, missiles, ballistic, and cruise didn't get through, partly because of Jordan. And I have a piece that just came out on the Hill about why Jordan supported Israel. It wasn't so much out of love for Israel. It was because they were afraid something would land in Jordan. And indeed, they found something that landed in the Dead Sea. So hitting Amman or hitting anywhere. Also, the king is custodian of the Temple Mount, of the Haram. And so there's a beautiful video of missiles right over the Dome of the Rock. So there were good reasons for Jordan to defend against these missiles, and they might do so again. Not the same with France, not the same with Britain, not necessarily the same with Saudi support. The Israelis have taken a big risk here, and it's true the Iranians have now said, well, it's over, we're not going to respond. But that was only one senior official. And we don't know how the Iranians will respond. They will respond. There's no question. And so maybe we go back to a shadow war, maybe not. And the pressure on Biden is going to continue, because if he's got this ironclad commitment to defend Israel, if the Iranians fire against Israel, Biden still has to do something to defend them. But that just alienates even more Democrats on the Hill. So he's caught between a terrible rock and a hard place, thanks to Bibi Netanyahu and his extremists. And the question really is, why do they have to do it this way when there were other options? They could take out more Iranian leaders out inside Iran through their usual mode of assassinations. They could take out facilities through cyber. Lots of things they could do. Why did they have to demonstrate that, oh, yes, we can penetrate your airspace, when the risk of losing the support they finally got put together in the last week is so great? I don't know. But then again, Bibi Netanyahu is sui generis.
One of the things which I think is fascinating about this, and again, I mean, something which strikes me, is that, you know, Israel, especially in its military operations, was both seen as both tactically extremely proficient, backed by very good intelligence, executed well, executed with discipline. Troops did not have a reputation for looting. Dove, you and I know a generation of Israeli soldiers, you know, who would have gotten into a lot of trouble if they'd done that. And, you know, moreover, sort of seen as astrategic, right? Sort of, well, what's the next step? And also a misreading of its adversaries occasionally, right? Israel, is the region, are the Israelis cognizant of the changes that are happening in Iran and a new generation of more sort of fanatical, for lack of a better word, messianic leaders, because they're partly driving this. And so as much as we hold Iran's current leadership, the Raisis, you know, and the Khamenei's in disdain, they ain't exactly spring chickens, and they're going to be replaced by people who may be more virulent and far less careful. I mean, do we sort of understand, and do the Israelis understand? Because they seem to have, you know, they were like, oh, we'll take these, you know, this latest batch out in Syria and nothing will happen. It turns out something happened.
Look, the Israelis clearly know what's going on in Iran. If they didn't, they wouldn't have a lot of Iranian people helping them out, and they wouldn't know whom to target and where to target. So I think they do know. But then again, you don't know who's really going to take over after Raisi. And the reason is simply because the country itself is suffering badly economically and has demonstrations all the time and is barely stable. Right. And so an extremist taking over could bring the whole house down. So we just don't know. It's a very complicated process that gets somebody to become supreme leader anyway. There are lots of competitors for that one. We don't know about that. The real problem is that Israel had lost its coalition because of Gaza. Luckily, in a weird way, was able to cobble it together again because of the Iranian attack. and now has risked undoing it. And in that sense, the Israelis, or at least the extreme right wing with which Bibi now is clearly a part of, they just don't seem to care. But then again, one could argue that there are lots of things they're doing in Gaza which make absolutely no sense and which are not necessary. And again, it just demonstrates that they don't care. And I think underlying it all are two things. One is Bibi thinks he's got Biden in a place where Biden cannot wiggle out of. And secondly, Bibi may well be figuring that if Trump comes in, everything changes anyway, although it's not at all clear, given Trump's own nature, whether he'd be supportive of Israel as he was last time around. Nobody knows. But Netanyahu, as everyone in Israel says, is looking out only for Netanyahu. And let me finish with a quick anecdote, which is, really tells you quite a story. A friend of mine was saw Shimon Peres, and I don't believe I've told this last time around. If I did, cut me off. He saw Shimon Peres 2 weeks before Peres died. And Peres said, you know, all of us cared about ourselves, meaning himself and all previous Israeli prime ministers. But when it came to between us and the state, we always supported the state, except for this guy who's in office now. That tells you everything you want to know about Bibi Netanyahu.
And it also tells you everything you need to know about Shimon Peres, who is one of history's great leaders, actually, somebody who I had a lot of affinity and enormous respect for. Having met him and interacted with him. Patrick, get your sense in this. Jim, I'm going to come to you about whether or not this changes kind of any of European dynamics at the end of the day. As I said, we're willing to take some fingers in the eye, but I'm not necessarily sure the British and the French might be as willing to do that. But Patrick, you know, you're the one person in this group who's actually visited Isfahan, right? I mean, what are some of the challenges, right? I mean, when people talk about strikes, and indeed, there are a lot of right of center Americans, Ambassador Bolton is one of them, right? It's like it's time to attack him and get this problem solved once and for all. You hear this cry repeatedly. Indeed, it's what propelled the Iran nuclear deal. I mean, I remember talking to an Israeli official who said, listen, we're going to start it and you're going to finish it. And that was one of the reasons the administration was like, well, no, actually, we're going to stop this because we're not interested in fighting another war in the Middle East, and one that would actually be more problematic against an actual, you know, sort of great power in the region, or at least an important regional power. What is it we need to bear in mind about how the Iranians have set all of this up? Because, right, they're Iranian, they're not stupid.
Well, while I have several nuclear sites, I mean, Isfahan is a major one, but it is vast, it is well defended, it is burrowed in the mountains, and it's a great distance away from most places, including Israel. I have no doubt the Israeli Defense Force are extremely capable of hitting their targets when they're aiming. And they clearly did get through this time, just as the Iranian weapons at least made it into Israel, although not many on the ground. You know, so we're in a very dangerous situation, but it's not clear that you could sustain a large-scale strike and seriously cripple the Iranian nuclear program. And as Dov pointed out, most importantly, you wouldn't be getting all of it. So you're still dealing with a potentially nuclear Iran on top of everything else. There are 3,000 plus missiles. If you're going to trigger a central major war, you know, what is your strategy? So that's why we've seen these two very calibrated attacks that have gone directly into Iran, directly into Israel first. And yet it's not clear what's the next move. And the rest of the world is watching very much, because everybody wants to know, is force usable? Can we get our way? Ask China, North Korea. And so this is a very dangerous situation here in the Middle East. But Israel did send the message. They can get through. I'm sure they can. And they can put down some punishing strikes, but it's not easy at Isfahan.
I mean, the question is, and I think the Iranians may already have taken that decision, right? Instead of responding, just go ahead and develop a nuclear weapon. Or my concern, they may already have developed that capability. And that last weekend's test was indeed a test to sort of, for an operational concept. If I only have a handful of nuclear weapons, I am messianic in my approach and I am a 12th Imamist, you know. Okay, you know, I only have a couple of nuclear wolves. I have to figure out a way to try to sneak it in with the conventional sheep. So anyway, I mean, that's kind of my concern, is each action has an equal opposite reaction ultimately. And, you know, everybody gets a choice at this, unfortunately. Jim, just to get your sense on this, right, what's sort of the response from Britain and France, considering, you know, both countries, you know, played an important role, or played a role, played an important role. Every hand helps in a when it's an all hands on deck endeavor. And two countries that did urge Israel not to strike back. You could argue the Israelis were very measured. It wasn't indiscriminate. Frankly, they didn't have to respond now, right? They did so in part because everybody told them not to. And so Bibi kind of has to do his own thing. But ultimately, how is that playing? And does this dampen any enthusiasm, you know, Britain and France would have to try to help out the next time?
Well, just a couple things. Before I get into that, you know, the New York Times had an article, I think it was Thursday, that really went into detail about all the back channels that were operating throughout this crisis period, trying to tamp down Iran, trying to tamp down Israel, and keep a lid on this boiling pot. A lot of those back channels were European. The Turks were part of that. The Swiss, of course, were representing us. The allies at NATO were getting phone calls. France, UK. And it's interesting when you look at partners who are helping out, not just in the strike, which I'll talk about in a second, but even before the strikes, calling to both contacts in Iran, because a lot of these nations have relations with Iran, but also dealing with Israel and talking to the Israeli government. It really took a large number of interlocutors to try to keep everybody calm and cool, and let this choreography take place without causing a regional war. And so I really recommend that article. I had no idea it was as right. multifaceted as it was. But in terms of the strike and Israel and the French and British participation, you know, a lot of what drives them is their own domestic problems too. Particularly in France, but UK as well, there's certainly a jump in anti-Semitism. I think there was a stabbing today or yesterday in the south of France. I thought I saw somewhere. And also the French were flying out of a base in Jordan, I believe. I think they share a base with the Jordanian Air Force and the U.S.
Right.
So what they were doing was probably in the defense of Jordan as well. I mean, if the Jordanians felt that they didn't want those missiles to be falling into Jordan, well, France was going to help them make sure none of them did. And so there's a lot of other reasons and motivations behind Allied participation in the strikes, you know, putting their head over the parapet here, that had to deal with what was happening in their own homes, if you will, back in their countries, and also dealing with their relationships in the region. So that's what drove a lot of those two countries to want to play an active role, more than just being a back channel, but actually taking out those missiles.
I should point out, right, I mean, to Iranians as Shias, to Dove's point, right, I mean, the Dome of the Rock is not an important feature in their interpretation of Islam. So, right, so that's why it's somewhat more important to the direct descendant of the Prophet Muhammad in the form of King Abdullah, as opposed to the Shias. Let me ask this question, and Jim, right, I mean, the situation in Ukraine is getting more dire, and as that situation gets more dire and Putin feels more emboldened, we're seeing a lot of activity. Germany just arrested two Russian spies, accusing them of being headed to Baden-Baden, where the United States is training Ukrainians. There, if you look at disinformation or misinformation or social media engagement heat maps, there are a lot of Russian fingerprints that are propelling or accentuating or exacerbating anti-Semitism in the United States. They're supporting some pro-Palestinian movements as well, right? I mean, everything is designed, you know, it's not for affinity with Palestinians. It's merely to fracture and divide American society, right? A border gets involved. I know the Chinese are involved in this as well, but we know definitively the Russians are doing it. And indeed, there was a great story. I think it was in the Times. It might have been in the Post, you know, detailing what the Russian plan is to divide the United States, to, you know, try to rip it apart as much as we can. And now you've got members of Congress, you know, we discussed this last week, and Michael, I want to come to you in a second. I mean, it's a pretty bold thing to send your agents out to attack an American base where Ukrainians are being trained, right? You know, how are Europeans looking at this? And Michael, at what point does the United States really need? And, you know, I understand you want to win a presidential election, but you also have to be cognizant enough that, you know, oh, and by the way, what are the other messages that we're getting out to try to counteract this? Because I think it's just, I mean, I think it's kind of too late. But anyway, I mean, what's your sense, Jim, on sort of, you know, what people are doing to counter this crap? Because
well,
it's toxic.
Well, I tell you, Europe is in the center of it. Europe is dealing with a tremendous amount of this disinformation and gray zone bullying, whether you're in Sweden, Norway, or down at the European Union or the European Parliament. They are uncovering every day these Russian efforts to penetrate and to misuse the social media. I mean, it's all over the place. And so what they're doing is they're exposing it, and which is helpful because it shows us the extent of Russian activity here. But they're doing a lot of education also with the public, saying this is what Russian misinformation, disinformation looks like. And so they're not keeping it to themselves. They're actively trying not just to educate kids, but adults as well. Don't fall for this. And it is getting difficult because of how sophisticated the Russian efforts are. And it's something that is only increasing. It is not going away around here. And it's having an impact, but I don't think it's as severe as the Russians would like it to be because of this education effort as well. It's blunting it somewhat, but they can't stop doing it because the Russians are increasing, as I said, the sophistication of how they go about presenting arguments and trying to push the other side and to push that Russian line. But it's everywhere. It is everywhere.
Michael? I mean, do folks on the Hill fully appreciate the magnitude of this? I mean, I understand everybody wants to score political points. Dove, I'm going to ask you about Columbia at the very end of the program because you're a distinguished graduate. But, you know, how many members fully appreciate the magnitude of the operations that are being conducted against the United States? I mean, the Russia, you know, the FBI director warned of, you know, sort of pre-operational probing the Russians were doing, and we saw Texas Water Authority being targeted. Retired Rear Admiral Mark Montgomery of the Center for Defensive Democracy has joined us to discuss this, you know, the magnitude of the operations against the United States to sort of identify weaknesses, because water systems are a hell of a weapon if you can trigger them. Do folks fully appreciate the magnitude of this threat up there as people are being useful idiots on a daily basis up there?
Right. And I think you're answering the question for yourself. We see more and more useful idiots up there, which shows that they do not understand the magnitude of this threat. And, you know, as you know, this is Russia says they have a partnership with China without limits. So it's not just the Russians, but it's the Chinese as well. And, you know, I've had a discussion with some of the folks on the China committee because, you know, we've seen, unfortunately, Mike Gallagher has decided to resign from Congress effective tomorrow. And I think, you know, one of the successes of the China committee has been that the members of the committee understand the threat, because many of these people did not serve on national security committees prior and now have exposure to this, and they understand the threats that we face, but it hasn't gotten beyond that committee and then beyond other national security committees in Congress. And that's something that needs to be done. And it's a real problem within the Republican Party, going back to, you know, during Trump's presidency, when he looked at Russia differently than Republicans have in the past. And at his press conference in Helsinki, with Putin years ago, you know, really took Putin's side over our own intelligence community side over whether the Russians were interfering in our elections. So you've got this culture now of folks in the Republican Party that are willing to give the Russians the benefit of the doubt before listening to their own intelligence community here in the United States. So it's a very, very serious problem. And also you have the media outlets that they listen to, like Newsmax, OAN, and Fox, also parroting that information, not only to these members of Congress, but to their base. Which they feel their job is to placate and not inform and educate.
It's depressing. I don't know what other language to put around it. Those French fighters, by the way, are based at Prince Hassan Air Base in Safawi, which is, I think, northeast of about 75 or so miles northeast of Amman. Patrick, I mean, obviously, a lot of news across the Indo-Pacific to try to tackle. But your sense on sort of the Chinese role in this, right? I mean, we talk about a limitless partnership. The Chinese are trying to exacerbate these fissures as well. I think the Russians are far, far more active, but the Russians are not, the Chinese are not inactive, right? What, how are they advancing some of these arguments, and what are some of the lines of argumentation that we see from China that we need to be most, you know, sort of attuned to? What are the sorts of ways the Chinese are trying to divide us, right? I mean, we know that there's a definitive plan, a Russian plan that we've now seen, and they are doing all of the things that they've discussed, right? I mean, even though this document is about a year old before it made it public. And the Chinese don't do anything without a plan either. I mean, to paraphrase Fred Thompson and, you know, Hunt for Red October, I mean, the Ruskies don't do anything without, don't take a dump without a plan, son, right? Neither do the Chinese. If they're flying a balloon over America, there's a reason they're flying a balloon over America. Anyway, give us your sense.
Well, it's important to know what we don't see. And what we don't see from China, as we don't see from Russia until Catherine Belton revealed this classified annex to the rather mundane foreign policy concept that Russia put out last year, which used the official language of we're going to democratize international relations. That's a phrase that the Chinese use. And so you wonder immediately, aren't the Chinese doing the same thing then secretly? And the answer is no kidding. Yes. And yet we don't have the empirical evidence the way we do with the daily onslaught of the narrative that comes out of the Chinese propaganda machine and state media. So this week we had, of course, a telephone call between the Secretary of Defense and his counterpart, first time since November of 2022. We have a series of diplomatic talks, of economic talks going on this week and next week. And yet for all of that, the entire U.S.-China relationship is creaking because the competition in the military realm, think South China Sea and Taiwan, in the economic realm, you know, talk about technology and shipbuilding and TikTok and fentanyl, and in the diplomatic realm where Wang Yi right now is heading to Indonesia, Cambodia, Papua New Guinea, ahead of meeting with the Secretary of State Blinken next week. And you've got some intense talking points going on right now, and, you know, accusing the United States of working with small circles to stir up trouble. That's, I suppose, in contrast to being a big hegemonic bully like China. And then it's talking about threatening the Philippines, saying you're going to only hurt your security by inviting not just BrahMos supersonic cruise missiles, which just arrived, but also the American first deployment of their strategic mid-range fire systems, this, you know, with firing Tomahawk and SM-6 missiles for the Balakatan exercise. The Chinese are saying, look, you're only going to hurt your security. And it sounds like a threat that they're going to put missiles on some of the Spratly artificial fortified reefs that they've built up. They already have fortifications there, but they could put bigger missiles on those islands if they really want to make a splash. And I suspect they might after this. So there's a lot going on here with both what we see and what we don't see in China. What are they doing to help the Russians? Well, they've been backstopping their economy first and foremost. Secretary Blinken says he's going to bring this issue up again next week. But, you know, the Chinese don't care. You know, they're not going to stop. They just stop trying to make it be so visible. But we did also hear in the defense testimony before the House this week with C.Q. Brown and Secretary Austin that, you know, it is still mostly indirect support when you think about what the Chinese are providing the Russian military, because the Russian military is using that economic gain to start up their munitions factories, and it may not be cutting edge technology, but it's good enough for fighting, especially when the Americans and others are not equipping the Ukrainians for that fight. As for what they're doing with Iran, you know, China doesn't want to get involved in a wider war in the Middle East. Nobody seems to want a wider war, not even the Iranians. But at the same time, they're definitely backing sort of the wrong side, you know, very much siding with supporting Iran, supporting the Palestinian cause at the expense of the Israelis, not taking on the real threat of terrorism, of proliferation in the Middle East. So Iran is on the wrong side of these issues from a U.S. national interest perspective, but at the same time, they're trying to do it mostly covertly and without being too visible.
You mentioned the Chinese visits regaining ground in Micronesia, right? I mean, which is part of, you know, an important part of their strategy. And then Australia, in turn, dramatically planning to increase defense spending to build up some of those capabilities with which to counter the Chinese.
Yeah, the election that just happened in the Solomon Islands this week is important, and the final results, we're still waiting for the final, but the tallies are essentially done. And Sogavare, the pro-China leader, has been reelected by these tallies. And that's not a big surprise because he's been relying on Chinese money to build a stadium in the first instance to show that he could run some regional games. But really, he's allowed Huawei telecoms to go up on the islands. He's agreed to a secret security pact that he denies is what we think it is. But at the same time, they're not being very transparent with it. On the other hand, they did on one of the islands, one of the most pro-Chinese local officials lost his re-election bid. So that was an interesting mixed message if these results hold in the Solomon Islands. Australia, yes, did hike their defense spending. It's significant what the Australians are committed to over the next decade, going up eventually to 2.4% of GDP spending on defense. Although I would note that a lot of that money is pushed off for the final 6 years of that 10-year. So not unusual for democratically elected governments to try to forestall the pain of what it costs to provide for one's defense.
I should have said Oceania, Micronesia. A couple of other quick agenda items. Last one will be obviously on North Korea because it was a weird Kim Il-sung birthday. But Ma just came back from China, and everybody's clearly misunderstanding. Where China is. Walk us through some of the messaging surrounded with the former Taiwanese leader's return from China to Taiwan. Why we should be embracing our Chinese overlords.
Well, we're only weeks away from the inauguration of Lai Ching-te and, continuing the Democratic Progressive Party rule in Taiwan, which Beijing sees as a separatist enterprise. So they used very much the reunion with Ma Ying-jeou and meeting this time, his second trip to China in a year, but this time meeting with Xi Jinping last week to emphasize the fact that the 92 consensus should hold, that Taiwan is inevitably going to be unified. And it already is part of historic China. So all of those are the messages that Beijing wants the region, wants Taiwan to know. Meanwhile, the debate here in the United States, especially during this election year, is heating up over the Taiwan scenario issues. And so some very important pieces put out this week, one of them by somebody I have great respect for, Admiral Mike Studeman, retired, stepped down last year, head of Navy intelligence, a China expert, talking in the War in the Rocks about how China's battening down for the gathering storm over Taiwan. He's not wrong about that. Undeniably, China's building up. But at the same time, as we see with the handling of Ma, the Chinese want to do this their own way. They want unification on their terms without a conflict. But they are definitely preparing for one. And the question is, what do we do in return? And some of what we do is to make sure that we provide Taiwan what they need defensively. Right. And we can do a better job of that. But we also need a political and economic strategy. And that's where discussion that came out of Brookings this past week, a very thoughtful discussion by a whole series of people, show that this is a complex matter, and we don't want to make it just a military matter as much right. as that matters.
Let me very briefly, because we've got about 2 minutes left in the show, Xi and Scholz, and very quickly your thoughts, and then want to get Dove before we part.
Well, the big picture on the economy is that while China's touting this 5.3% first quarter growth as being showing the strength and that the China peak theory is wrong, I think there are lots of uncertainties about the Chinese economy. And a lot of people think they're going down the wrong way, wrong road in terms of scaring away economic investment and trade and technology. And yet the relationship with Germany, done very quietly with Chancellor Scholz, China's really hoping that that Germany becomes one of their bigger new economic partners. It's already a big partner. They've grown tremendously in the past 10 years since they've had this special relationship. And China's counting on Germany. Germany, we'll see. I mean, Scholz was circumspect. He raised some of the tough issues, apparently.
Right.
But we'll see. Their economic interests are very much driven by this.
And why is it a weird Kim Il-sung Day of the Sun?
Yeah. So Day of the Sun is the most important holiday in North Korea. It is the anniversary of the birth of Kim Il-sung, the founder, 112th year. There was no military parade. Lots of arts festivals, very muted. Did have the number three Chinese official in town. But they were downplaying idolatry about Kim Il-sung. This is Kim Jong-un is now the new Kim Il-sung. And his daughter, Kim Ju-ae, is being built up, and she's been given new names. So we're now in a new era in North Korea's leadership. Kim Jong-un is clearly in charge, and he's already grooming his daughter, even though she may be a decade away from ever being formally announced as a successor.
Wow. Fascinating. Dove, very quickly, a day after the Columbia University president was being bombarded by members on the Hill, she tried very much to avoid the fate that happened to Harvard University of Pennsylvania and MIT, which ended badly for two of those three. You know, ended a Palestinian demonstration on pro-Palestinian demonstration on Columbia's campus. You were there when there were quite a few demonstrations on Columbia University's campus. And anyway, walk us through this message this potentially sends, because as you've always made the case, there's a line between anti-Semitism, but then, you know, either being pro-Palestinian or critical of the Israeli government. You know, what's the line here? You think, as you're a proud Columbia undergraduate recipient?
Well, first, a little bit of additional news about that Israeli strike. The Israelis actually never said anything officially about it, which lets me believe that maybe those reports about Israel discussing next steps with the United States and with and the meetings with the foreign ministers of the key allies that supported them may have led to what a lot of people are saying was more of a demonstrative act. They went after an airbase because the Iranians went after an airbase. However, having said that they didn't say anything, one big idiot in Israel did, and that was Ben-Gvir, the extremist right-wing minister, who not only talked about it, but said that it was too weak a response. So we Americans have
Excellent.
A major... Because this idiot is leading, I believe, Netanyahu by the nose. Having said all of that, yes, I was there in 1968 during all the riots, and they called in the tactical police force. The current president, Mnuchin, she had, I would give her a B+ on her testimony because she was very clear about genocide and all that. What she wasn't as clear about was whether from the river to the sea phrase, which a lot of people think is a way of just driving out 7 million Jews into nowhere, she kind of tried to wiggle around it. But she does get a B+. She was better prepared. She was smoother. And frankly, she was more honest. Now, the next day, there were these big tents on what's called Columbia South Lawn. Whenever you see a picture of Columbia, that's what you see in front of that statue of alma mater. They had these big tents up there. They were clearly intimidating anybody who had anything other than what the pro-Palestinian folks thought was the right position. And they were disrupting education. And so she felt she had absolutely no alternative but to call in the cops. And what they do, of course, is they arrested over 100 people. They arrest them. They let them out of jail real quick. What Columbia did the year after the 68 riots That is to say, in 69, when they tried it again. And oh, by the way, these things always happen in April or May because it's just before finals. And that way everybody gets pass fail. Don't forget that. And nobody has to study. But what they did in 69 was they named people and they said they'd prosecute them. And so the kids who wanted to become lawyers, if they got prosecuted and convicted, couldn't become lawyers. And they'd all have to go into daddy's business if they had a daddy's business. I don't know if they're going to do that again, but it's clear that the current president of Columbia is not going to take this. You know, she doesn't mind speaking out, but she believes that there's a limit. And once it's going to affect education, which she argues it did, she's obviously taking very strong steps.
Guys, thanks very much for joining me today. As always, terrific conversation. Thank you very much. Hope everybody has a great weekend, a great week, a happy Passover to you, Dove, Michael, and to the rest of the audience. Although we will be back again on Sunday for the business roundtable. Until then, hope everybody has a great weekend.